Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming to the Lowy Institute today for our event, Denuclearization and Human Rights in North Korea. Can we have one without the other? My name's Meriden Viral, and I'm the East Asia Program Director here at the Lowy Institute. Before we go any further, I'd like to acknowledge that this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay respect to their elders past and present and any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders who are in the audience today. So we're going to be discussing a pretty complex issue today, so I'll start with a quick overview of the situation and where we are at the moment. The Democratic Republic of North Korea, has technically been at war with South Korea, an ally of the US, since the Korean War started in 1950, although an armistice signed in 1953 divided the two areas with a demilitarized zone, and that's still the state of the situation today. Since that time, the Kim family has ruled the country. The current chairman, Kim Jong-un, is the third generation of Kims. To put the current situation in simple terms, for many years, North Korea has been attempting to develop a nuclear weapon that it can attach to a missile to strike at its enemies. Most experts, including those at the US Pentagon, believe that the country wants this capability as a deterrent so that no foreign power, for example, the United States, would dare to attempt to remove the Kim regime from power. Under the current chairman, Kim Jong-un, North Korea has accelerated its nuclear program to the point where it can now produce a new bomb, we are told, every 6 to 7 weeks. And it now has an intercontinental ballistic missile on which it can attach that nuclear weapon that is theoretically capable of hitting any part of the United States. The US and others have been trying to come to some sort of negotiated agreement with North Korea since the mid-1980s. Twice things have come close. In 1994, the final year of the first Kim's leadership, we had the agreed framework. And in 2003, under his son and successor, with the six-party talks. But both of these ultimately collapsed and North Korea resumed its nuclear program. In June this year, we had US President Trump and Chairman Kim meeting in Singapore for what is usually described as a landmark summit. The two men signed a document to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula and to work towards the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And just to note that the DPRK did not agree to complete, verifiable and irreversible nuclear disarmament, but rather the North Koreans reaffirmed their commitment to something that they signed earlier in April this year with South Korea, the Panmunjom Declaration. Now, in his enthusiasm to get something done, President Trump agreed to some measures that appear to be a fundamental departure from previous US policy, decades of US policy in the region, in exchange for North Korean denuclearization, particularly significantly reduced US military presence, promising to end the joint US-South Korean military exercises, which he called war games, and eventually withdraw US troops from the Korean Peninsula. There's been a lot of discussion about who got the best deal out of this summit, out of this meeting, who or if anyone got duped. But absent from all this discussion, noticeably absent, is any mention of human rights. Our international organisations describe the human rights situation in North Korea as absolutely egregious, whereas the North Korean government strongly denies most of these allegations and accuses international organisations of fabricating human rights abuses as part of a smear campaign with a covert intention of changing the regime, although they do admit that there are some human rights issues relating to living conditions, which the government is attempting to correct. Now, Trump is conspicuously ignoring the question of human rights. He, like South Korean President Moon and others, appear to be deliberately leaving out the issue of human rights, possibly as a strategic move to get something done and to avoid derailing the denuclearization process with the idea that something is better than a perfect nothing. Will that work? Does it matter? If so, why? So today what we're going to do is not go through in great detail who said they would do what, when, how it's going, whether or not Trump and Kim are doing what they said they would do. What we're going to try and do instead is bring these questions, these ideas of security and human rights together and explore whether or not we do need to include the issue of human rights as a fundamental precondition for peace and security in a sustainable way on the Korean Peninsula. And to do that, I'm joined by the Honourable Michael Kirby and Dr. Byeom-chul Shin, to discuss this complex situation. Now, Dr. Shin is eminently qualified to discuss the issue of security on the Korean Peninsula. He's a senior fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Korea. Until March this year, Dr. Shin was professor at the Korean National Diplomatic Academy. He also served for the ROK Ministry of Foreign Affairs and was the head of the North Korean Military Studies Research Division at the Korea Institute for Defense Analysis. Prior to that, Dr. Shin worked closely with the Korean Minister of National Defense as a senior policy advisor and also served in many other policy advisory positions, both at the National Security Council, at the Office of the President, and the National Assembly Foreign Affairs and Unification Committee, and is also the author of several books on law and security. So we welcome you, Dr. Shin, and thank you for joining us today. To my left is the Honourable Michael Kirby, international jurist, university professor, visiting fellow, past Justice of the High Court of Australia from 1996 to 2009, Editor-in-Chief of the Laws of Australia, member of the board of the Australian Centre for International Commercial Arbitration, and perhaps most relevantly for this discussion, Mr. Kirby was the chair of the United Nations Human Rights Council's Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in the DPRK from 2013 to 2014. Now, this UN Commission on Human Rights Abuses, which Mr. Kirby headed up, established beyond a doubt how appalling the human rights situation in North Korea is. Mr. Kirby compared North Korea to Nazi Germany and its gulags to Auschwitz. The mandate from the UN and the Human Rights Commission has ceased, has now concluded. However, Mr. Kirby remains committed to ensuring that human rights in North Korea will not be overlooked in the focus on security. So I'm going to have a moderated discussion among the three of us, and then we'll open the floor up to questions for all of you for the last 20 minutes or so. So please think about what you might like to ask Dr. Shin and Mr. Kirby. So the first question is for you, Dr. Shin. If the nuclear issues on the Korean Peninsula are resolved, it will have profound implications for the security of the region. Do you think the Trump-Kim summit will take things in the right direction, in a positive direction? And can you talk a little bit about what that might look like?
Yeah, thank you, Marilyn, for your wonderful introduction. And also thank you for Counselor General Yoon for providing me such kind of support. Regarding your question, I think it's a positive direction, but we cannot put to solve the challenges currently face. Why this is a positive direction? I think that simply that the dialogue is better than confrontation. And starting from the President Moon's initiative, Pyeongchang Peace Process, we now had the North Korea-U.S. summit. As you mentioned, that the June 12 summit was successful in 3 points. First one is two countries promised to improve its bilateral relations. That's the reason why President Trump continuously made a good comment on the Chairman Kim. Second one is the trust-building process. And for that purpose, President Trump somewhat unilaterally announced that postponed suspension of a military drill, joint military drill with South Korea. We annually have three military drill, the UFG in August, and the four key reserve in March, and four Eagle military drill in April. We suspended those three military drill as a confidence building measure to North Korea. And North Korea took some steps for denuclearization. One is a dismantle of its nuclear site in Punggye-ri. They dismantled the nuclear site. They bombed the nuclear site. And then North Korea started the dismantle of missile engine site. We have a satellite picture that North Korea tried to dismantle this kind of a missile test site. So this is an improvement. But we still face some deadlock. The deadlock is a kind of a rule of a game. North Korea wants a kind of a salami negotiation. They have a lot of nuclear facilities. They divided them and a separate negotiation with a separate compensation by United States. North Korea believe that since they dismantled nuclear test site, United States compensated the suspension of suspension of a military drill. Now North Korea demand the United States as a declaration to end the Korean War in a compensation with their steps for the dismantling their missile engine test site. But on the other hand, United States doesn't want that kind of salami tactics. They want a more comprehensive approach on denuclearization of North Korea. One is a report, the other is verification, and then dismantle of nuclear capability. So what United States demand now is, if North Korea made a report of each nuclear facility, then United States compensate with it as a declaration to end the Korean War. But still, North Korea doesn't want to make a report, so there is a deadlock in negotiation. So if we cannot solve this deadlock within a certain period, we face a serious problem. So that is the current situation on negotiation between North Korea and the United States.
Thank you. So, Mr. Kirby, this issue of peace on the peninsula and trying to denuclearize in North Korea, you said earlier this year on SBS there will never be peace on the Korean peninsula while there are grave human rights abuses occurring in North Korea. Can you explain that a little bit? Can you describe a bit the situation of human rights in North Korea and help us understand why that matters to peace more broadly?
The situation of human rights in North Korea does not, according to the information I have, improve. It hasn't been improved. There's no evidence that it has improved for the ordinary people. And on the contrary, the evidence of drought conditions and the recurring problem of the food supply seem to indicate that there's a significant humanitarian crisis at the moment, if not that it's growing, and this has itself been the subject of statements in the last day or so from the Security Council concerning the clarification of the exemptions from the UN sanctions for the humanitarian crises that exist or are looming. This is the position that we start with, the report of the Commission of Inquiry, which unfortunately in the pathetic situation of book publishing in this world, I was not able to get anybody to agree to publish it. It's not such a big deal. It ought to be available. It ought to be available for everybody who's involved in this. There's no point in doing reports and then putting them in the basement of the UN buildings. This is a very readable report. Every word was weighed. It's a report that tells a terrible story, and it ought to be readily available, but there are so much rubbish at airports and in book publishers that get greater priority, and therefore it's not available. Well, that's disgraceful, but there it is. The best chapter in the report is not the chapter on the disrespect of women, on the women sent back from China, on condition of political suspects in detention camps, and the suppression of religion, the abductions of people, including Japanese nationals. All of those are very important issues. But the best chapter in the report is the chapter on food, the chapter on the food supply. They just don't have a proper economy in North Korea. They used to supply food on coupons. I'm old enough to remember coupons after the Second World War. I would go to the local milk shop and hand over a yellow coupon, like a stamp, and then I could buy a little bit of milk, a pail of milk, or a little bit of butter. And that was the system they had in North Korea, and it worked reasonably well, but it's collapsed. And therefore the food supply is a real problem, and it's the basic requirement of a state to supply food to its people. And from what one reads about the problem of the drought, the food supply is bad and getting worse, and therefore, that's a really serious human rights problem. Number of people who are dying for want of food is contested. We took a lower estimate than the often repeated estimate of a million people having died in the 1990s. We thought it was probably more like 200 or 300,000, but that's an awful lot of people. The population of North Korea is roughly the same as Australia. And if we had had 200,000 people who died in the 1990s in Australia, we would take a century to get over a disaster of that kind. But I'm torn. I have to admit, I'm torn between, on the one hand, my satisfaction that President Moon's initiative has led to the meeting with Mr. Trump, and that that is itself definitely a good thing. Today, we are in the midst of those days in Japan that are remembered for the explosion of the nuclear weapons over Hiroshima and then Nagasaki, 6th and 9th. And it's therefore appropriate we're meeting today. And this is not, we're not talking about a big bomb. We're talking about a very different kind of weapon, a weapon truly of mass destruction. And it is a great threat to peace. It's a great threat to the people of Korea, North and South. The people of South Korea are naturally, very understandably, concerned, deeply concerned about their security. They're only 100 kilometres away from the potential launching of these weapons upon them. So it's a good thing that there was discussion. But the normal way in which you engage in discussion, and I've discussed this with the representatives of the State Department when they were playing a leading role in this, the normal way you deal with a negotiation is you put the really hard things in the core, they're in the middle, and then you work around the edges and you find things that you can agree on. And the sorts of things you might agree on in this case would be meeting with the President of the United States and the Chairman of North Korea. That's a giveaway, a card. Then you would move to the war games. Then you would move to a postal service. Not a big ask in the 21st century that you should be able to post a letter from North Korea to South Korea. Then you would work to telephone contacts. And then you would be working towards steps to improve the human rights. It's a shocking thing that families, people now in their 90s, have not met their relatives for 60 years. And it's a disgrace. I was told recently by Mr. Shin that they're going to be meeting with, I think it's 93 families, and many of them are in their 90s. So you would deal with all these things, and then you'd work your way to the hard core, which is human rights and nuclearization, denuclearization. But we haven't done it that way. And this is because Mr. Trump has a very great belief in his own capacity as a deal maker. This is something rather more complex and important than a real estate deal in New York. And it's really not been handled, I think, in a very appropriate way. And I insist that you can't take human rights off the agenda. The world promised you would not do that. And we can't take it off the agenda. And it's not there in the four-point agreement between President Trump and Chairman Kim. And it's hard, once you don't do it in the regular way, to put it back on the table. If the card isn't dealt with, it's very hard to deal it, to play it later in the game. So I don't know where we're going. I don't know where we've got to. It's not very transparent. And whilst I'm happy that there is discussion, I'm very deeply concerned about the human rights of the people of North Korea. They matter to me, they matter to the world, and they matter to the Korean people.
Thank you. Dr. Shin, this connection between human rights and security, Mr. Kirby talked about human rights haven't improved. And the question of these sorts of easier things that you could do in a negotiation, for example, maybe setting up a postal service or telephone connections, from our point of view, are human rights issues. But from the North Korean point of view, these are security issues because they mean that infiltration of information could take place. So is that what the connection is between human rights and security as far as the North Korean regime is concerned? And if that's the case, how does it work with human rights and nuclear capabilities? Is there the same kind of fundamental sense of insecurity behind both of those things? So the argument that the nuclearization in North Korea is about protecting the regime, is the way that people are being treated in North Korea also about protecting the regime? Is that the human rights security connection? So what purpose does it serve Kim to continue this kind of human rights treatment of its people?
Yes, you are right. It's closely interrelated, and Chairman Kim's perspective is a kind of a challenge to consolidation of his regime. So he cannot put the control over his own people, restricting the political right. On the other hand, the security side, he cannot put to addict to the nuclear weapon because he believes he's insecure. He needs the ultimate weapon to protect the regime from the external power. So he cannot put to addict the nuclear regime. So I believe that the nuclear weapon and the human rights issue is the kind of a different side of the same coin. For North Korea, it is very hard to speak on the human rights issue because they believe there is a kind of a disgrace of the regime, and they feel like there is a kind of a challenge to their own regime, so they refused to talk about the human rights issue whenever we talk with North Korea. So the raising the human rights issue is a kind of a deal breaker with North Korea. So South Korean government approach is a little bit flexible. We cannot directly talk about the political human rights. So instead, we talk about Honorable Corby mentioned that the communication. We try to exchange more, and then so give more opportunity for the information, and then we focus on the economic and social rights. So we try to provide economic aid, and then food aid, and or sometimes medical aid to North Korea, so living standard might be getting better. That's our indirect approach to human rights issue. However, at the end, we want to solve the human rights issue in North Korea. So maybe we do not speak officially, but I think there is some kind of priority for Korean government. The first thing is to decrease North Korea's military threat. That is a top priority. Second might be the exchange of people and kind of a coexistence of two Koreas on the peninsula, and then improving human rights issue. So final target is we always think about the human rights.
South Korean President Moon has a background as a human rights lawyer and a human rights activist, so presumably it's on his mind, it's on his agenda. So are you arguing then that the lack of discussion of human rights is a strategic approach, because if you raise them too forcefully now, they could derail the process and nothing would be achieved?
Yes, exactly. So we would not say that is a strategic approach.
Naturally.
But naturally, we cannot afford to take that kind of indirect way to make more opportunity to meet North Korea, give them more chance for change. So we first expand our cooperation with the North, and then try to improve the human rights situation in the North.
And Mr. Kirby, when Dr. Shin was talking about the way in which South Korea is approaching that human rights issue, it sounds like a slight shift in definition of human rights, a little bit more along the lines of how maybe China defines them and how North Korea has defined them as well in terms of living conditions, rather than the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Do you think that's an effective approach?
I'd love to agree with that, but I can't, because in every country there are human rights abuses. Let's face it, in Australia, the way we're dealing with refugees is contrary to the Refugees Convention. Every country has human rights abuses. We're not talking about that. We're talking about crimes against humanity. We were asked by the Human Rights Council to concentrate on crimes against humanity, and that's what we did. We found various abuses, they're listed in the report, but we also found that there were a number of these abuses which rose to the level of crimes against humanity, which were defined immediately after the Second World War in the efforts of the international community at Nuremberg, Tokyo and elsewhere to respond to really terrible crimes of violence performed as an act of state which shocked the conscience of humankind. So that's the definition. And we said that there were a number of these which could be demonstrated not beyond reasonable doubt, as you said at the beginning, because we were not a prosecutor or a court, but that we were a fact finder. We said it was found on the basis of probability that there was established evidence that should go to a prosecutor and should be the subject of investigation by a prosecutor with a view to its being placed before an independent tribunal. Now, what the world promised in 1945 was, in the light of the Holocaust and the terrible discoveries after the war, that the world, the United Nations, would never turn its back on crimes against humanity. And that's effectively what we're doing in this negotiation. We're saying, put aside the human rights abuses, look at the crimes against humanity. What are we doing? Nothing. It's not mentioned in the four-point agreement. It's not mentioned in any of the discussion. Mr. Trump originally said it hadn't been mentioned at all, and then during the press conference, he sort of said, well, it was mentioned, but it wasn't, didn't go into any detail. Well, you can imagine how much detail was involved in that. So if we promise that we would always look at crimes against humanity, we've got to do something better than not mention it at all. And so this is the problem we face. And I understand it's difficult to mention it because the crime against humanity will normally attract condign attention and real response and punishment and by a transparent process of those who are guilty. But somehow we have to find a way that we will deal with that. And I am the first to accept, especially on these days, that nuclear weapons, the use of it and the threat of the use of it, is itself a human rights challenge. So it's not divorced from human rights. But we can't just take it off the table, I'm afraid. And somehow or other, we've got to try to get the whole issue dealt with at the one time, because if we don't put it on the table, it's just not going to be dealt with, because the regime in North Korea will not want to release its nuclear weapons without a lot of protection. And if that protection means ignoring the crimes against humanity, well, that's doing what we said in international law we would not do. And somehow we've got to find a solution to that quandary. The solution may lie down the track that Kim Jong-un and the surviving members of the family, including his sister, who looks a most agreeable woman, young woman, that they themselves were not the devisers of this regime, and they have not themselves actually done most of the terrible things that have been done by others in their name. But I'm sure that in his bathroom, Kim Jong-un has a photo of Saddam Hussein in the hole in Iraq and Gaddafi in the pipe in Libya, and that is what he says. And why would he release the very thing that protects him unless there's some sort of package deal that has provisions for transparently dealing with people who've actually done the most heinous crimes, and very big, a Marshall Plan type thing for the Korean Peninsula that has lots of economic inducements, the restoration of the roads and the railway lines which are still there that could be revived, the building of the infrastructure, and you can think in your mind of the things that can be done, but you can't just ignore crimes against humanity, I'm afraid. My duty is to keep saying that.
Thank you. Dr. Shin, from your sort of experience in the political realm in South Korea, how feasible is that in practice?
Yeah, we understand that the North Korea's human rights situation is horrible, but it seems like the negotiation with the devil. You know, the Kim Jong-un regime is the partner of nuclear negotiation, and then the improving inter-Korean relation, but raising the accountability issues. But they are the body who are accountable for those abuse of human rights. So it's very hard to raise directly on that issue. So it's a kind of a dilemma for South Korean government whenever we meet North Korea. So as I told you there, we put priority. If we solve the threat issue, if we improve inter-Korean relations, and then it's kind of a normalization of North Korea, maybe not right now, but 10 years later, North Korea's human rights situation might be normalized. That's the expectation for us for proceeding this kind of a negotiation.
So but there isn't a stimulus within North Korea to get the normalization. There's not the access to the internet. There's not the access to the international media. Mm-hmm. There's not the access to civil society, which will criticize its government, mm-hmm. as happens all the time in South Korea. And this is the problem. You're going to be sort of freezing a situation as of the here and now, but without any guarantee that there will be the processes that are needed to get the changes within North Korea. You can conceive of how this could be done, but you've got to go at it in a more logical way, and you've got to do something better than we will work towards denuclearization.
What about being passionately committed to it? That's something that we hear a lot, being passionately committed. Not working?
It didn't rise to that. It was a very soft obligation, work towards denuclearization. Well, that's why, let's face it, a lot of people have said Kim Jong-un really emerged triumphant from that deal. He got the pressure taken off. The sanctions still exist, but the pressure has been taken off, and nobody is now thinking of anything other than work towards, whatever that may mean. And meantime, terrible things are still happening. And this won't go away. It may not be able to buy it at Dimmock's, but it's here and it's online. And if the people of North Korea could only have access to the internet, they could read it and would cry.
We've talked a lot about this. You mentioned, Mr. Kirby, that Chairman Kim probably has a picture of Saddam and Gaddafi in his bathroom, and this idea that underneath everything, behind everything, is this fear and insecurity about this regime instability. There's a big context to that, isn't there? And it's not just the kind of the US or South Korea that we're talking about. We're talking about the region as well, more broadly, this regional context. It may be even things like the US-China trade tensions or the bilateral relations between the North and almost everybody else being in various degrees of tension. China, Japan, everyone in the region. Does this affect how Kim sees his domestic situation and the threat that he feels?
Yeah, I think it has a great portion on Kim Jong-un's policy decision-making process, because as of last December, when the international community agreed to make a sanction on North Korea, so the last one is 2397 UN Security Council resolution. At the time, China and Russia agreed to strongly implement that kind of a sanction. Then I think that make North Korea change, that come to the table. So the international cooperation affects North Korea's decision. And if China and Russia strongly demand to improve the human rights situation on North Korea, North Korea cannot but listen to their voices. However, at this moment, there's some different security environment compared to last December. Since we started the negotiation, the position of China and Russia is somewhat different. And recently, there is a huge competition between U.S. and China on the issue of tariff and trade. So the relation is deteriorating these days, which means the strategic value of North Korea increases in the Chinese foreign policy. That's all affecting North Korea's behavior, I think.
How
you know, so? I think it's a somewhat negative way. The reason to North Korea delay is a denuclearization process. It's somewhat affected by the Chinese support on North Korea because during the two times inter-Korean summit and one time North Korea-US summit, Kim Jong-un met Xi Jinping three times. With those three times, I think the economic situation in North Korea might be getting better. Although we have cut down 90% of North Korea's refined oil and limited the crude oil 4 million barrel, which means it's a drastic decrease of supply of oil to North Korea, but the oil price of North Korea still maintained at the same, which means that there is a support. I think in that way, in a secret way, I think Chinese support exists without, and that will negatively impact North Korea's decision on denuclearization.
Well, I think it is important that China and the Russian Federation A, have a borders with North Korea, B, must not be unconcerned about the dangers to them of the nuclear program of North Korea and the consequences if the situation deteriorates in North Korea for them, especially China, and C, that they have taken quite strong steps with the sanctions, and I was invited to go last December to the Security Council and sat in that beautiful chamber in New York at the bottom of 42nd Street, and I saw those 15 people, and they have worked as they should work towards a solution, but this step that has now happened is one which doesn't have a particular card in play, which I would like to have in play and which the international community promised would be in play. And that's the inescapable fact. And whatever now happens, we've got to put that card back in play. And that has to be made clear to those who have the responsibility of negotiation. And our governments have to make that very clear to the United States, and that includes the very influential government of Japan, as well as the Republic of Korea. And these things have to be revived, so that we just don't forget about this and say, "Oh well, it's just too difficult. We're not going to do anything about these things."
Yeah, I have one more quick point on China. Chinese policy on North Korea is very interesting. China wants denuclearization. However, they have their own priority. Their priority is a kind of a stabilization of North Korea and then denuclearization and peaceful resolution. The stabilization means that the political stability of Kim Jong-un regime, so China doesn't want to raise the issue of human rights. It destabilizes Kim Jong-un regime. And then China wants denuclearization. However, it doesn't want to destabilize the Kim Jong-un regime. So there's a certain limitation of its involvement on the sanction. And then denuclearization. Lastly, the peaceful resolution means that they want to negotiate those issues without the military option. With regard to the stabilization of the Kim Jong-un regime, there's a fundamental difference in position with the United States. So there is always some kind of tension between U.S. and China. And this time, because of the tension between U.S. and China, the value of North Korea increases. So the last time when Kim Jong-un met Xi Jinping in June, Xi Jinping made the word that the lips and teeth relation between China and North Korea. If that continues, it will be very hard to persuade China.
I admire what President Moon has done. His motivations are pure and good and strong, but there will be no peace unless somehow we build a civil society in North Korea, and we build a society which in many ways takes inspiration from the Republic of Korea, South Korea, and I only hope that those very clever people in the State Department that I met when I had this responsibility are working on a package which includes something like a Marshall Plan with cooperation with the Republic of Korea, which can put together a way to bring North Korea into the 21st century. After all, Kim Jong-un saw a modern society when he was being educated in Switzerland, and he knows how it works, and he knows its advantage. He just has to look at the economy of South Korea to know what an inducement can be made. They're very clever people in North Korea, as they've shown by bringing the nuclear weapons and the missiles into the high state that it is. And I hope that that wasn't a signal from forces afar that I've talked too much. I'm going to stop talking.
It was a gentle sign.
I have one point.
No, Dr. Shin, we have to open it up to the floor. I'm sorry.
Just one point. I'm not working for the Moon Jae-in administration, but actually Moon Jae-in administration also is concerned about the human rights issue and try to make the same effort that U.S. government has. But the problem is that we cannot officially pursue that kind of policy because we need to proceed the inter-Korean relation that eventually, we hope, improve North Korean's human rights situation.
Thank you. Now, we're going to open up to the floor for questions. The mic will come around. Please let us know your name and your affiliation.
Hi, my name is Heather Hope. I was wondering if you were going to structure the negotiations your way, what would the things that you would request, the easy things for human rights be, the ones on the outskirts before the core?
It's not much referred to because they're very detailed, like a postal service, a rail system, resumption of airline direct flights, city-to-city contacts, sporting contacts. The sporting contacts between North and South Korea have been supremely successful. And there was a wonderful story, which I think is referred to in the report, I think it was the Asian Games, and a minister flew down, and it was a soccer match in the final between North and South Korea. And whenever somebody fell over or was bumped, you didn't get the disputes we see in the World Cup. They would go over and pick up their colleague, and it was very moving, actually, to see it. And the Korean audience from the Republic of Korea kept calling out, "We are one, we are one." So, you know, people outside Korea can't fully understand the strong feelings that this engenders. But there's a whole long list that you could do, and it's all in the report, if only people could have access to
it. It is online. It's available online.
Yes,
Jen,
not in North Korea.
Not in North Korea. There's a question just down the front here. Sorry, Jen.
Thank you. My name's Jeff Miller, and I used to work in the Department of Foreign Affairs, including on North Asian issues. Comment is that years ago I remember a US State Department negotiator whose name was Bob Gallucci, who'd spent a lot of time, I think in the 60s, in a long negotiation with North Korea, talking about what that process was like. And he said it was absolutely excruciating and dreadful people to negotiate with, because you would offer something, they'd pocket it and then say, "Where's the next thing?" They'd say, "I would agree, but I have to refer home," when they wouldn't agree, and so on. And so that fits in, I think, the salami slicing tactics that you describe, I think, are the product of decades of practice. The question is, there seems to be a bit of comment coming at the moment from the US, which is really saying that is asking whether an agreement on nuclear matters is possible over the question of what does disarmament mean, and saying that while the US has this, I think three words, isn't it, reporting, verification and dismantling.
Irreversibility.
Complete, verifiable, yes. And irreversible.
Yeah, but North Korea, on the other hand, seems to be thinking of something which is at the very least Korean Peninsula-wide and may also include North Asia in general and the disposition of American power in North Asia, which is a much more complicated thing, but also it's clearly very different from what the Americans are asking for. So I wonder what any member of the group thinks of that difference, and is that likely to be a game breaker?
Maybe. And thank you for your question. I think there was different concept of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and the United States regards that's the denuclearization of North Korea. So North Korea, as Marilyn mentioned, that there's a completely the verifiable irreversible denuclearization of North Korea. So they give up their own nuclear weapon, and even further, give up their chemical and biological weapon. That's our means. But North Korea's argued that the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means that the U.S. nuclear weapon must be disappeared. So eventually, U.S. should promise that it will not attack North Korea with a nuclear weapon, and it will not bring the strategic asset to Korean Peninsula and Near Sea. And eventually, those U.S. forces in Korea must be retreated. That was the argument in the 2000 until 2016. But this time, North Korea maintain its ambiguity. I think that's the kind of a challenge, but also opportunity. The reason why North Korea do not mention that kind of a formal position is they have some willingness to change. South Korean government regard that is an opportunity. So we have the room for improving our negotiation to denuclearize North Korea on our way. That's our hope. But the process at this moment is very slow, so we have to restart the negotiation on the top-down approach, which means this time is unique because, as you mentioned, Galuchi, he was a negotiator in the 1990s, and we also have Christopher Hill. He was a negotiator in the 2000, throughout the 2000. But this time, it is not a bottom-up approach. For North Korea, Chairman Kim decide everything. So direct discussion with the Chairman Kim is important. That's a new approach of the Korean government and the U.S. government. If we are successful to persuade North Korea's Chairman Kim, then we might get a progress. So still, we have some hope. That's what I want to make a comment. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Suzanne Varel, and in full disclosure, I'm related to the moderator. I'm a former Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and Defence Foreign Policy Advisor. My question, though, concerns accountability for crimes against humanity. Justice Kirby, you mentioned your report is something of a fact-finding exercise, and what needs to happen is that it needs to go to a prosecutor, and this evidence needs to come before an independent tribunal. However, DPRK is not a member of the Rome Statute, the International Criminal Court, and we're not in a situation as in Nuremberg where we have a victorious set of allies and a defeated nation in the form of DPRK. And I'm just wondering if your report or the United Nations Security Council or you yourself have any ideas about how we can hold the leadership accountable for crimes against humanity in this situation, particularly when they are continuing. They're not ended. This is an ongoing situation.
Well, there's a whole section in the report that examines the various options. There were six options that were gone through and came down to three options, one of which included a truth and reconciliation type process, which is difficult to get going unless you've got the strength of the government and the commitment to going through the process of honesty and transparency. The United Nations Human Rights Council then set up another inquiry, which included one of the commissioners of the COI, and that also examined the various processes of accountability and transparency. I agree that it's difficult in the situation that exists in North Korea, but as Ambassador Miller said, you've got to go through the negotiation process in a more structured way. In fairness to President Trump, you've got to give him credit that he actually got them together. And just the optics and the fact of coming together, I think, makes it much more difficult to be talking in terms of fire and fury and laying the whole of North Korea waste, which is a grossly excessive threat, especially by a country that has large stockpile of nuclear weapons. How you would process it, I'm not sure. But the answer does seem to be doing it in a more regular way and working around the periphery, and there's a long list of things that could be done then, and then getting to that core issue and maybe not prosecuting every case, but having arrangements that provide for the prosecution of the most terrible cases that exist, and the United States, North and South Korea going with very heavy bundles of cash and opportunities. It'll be in the interest of the world eventually to avoid the dangers of nuclear weapons, which are most real in the Korean Peninsula, to do this. And we've just got to realise it's in our financial security and peace interests to do it, and our human rights interests to do it.
Hello, my name is Gary, I'm a private citizen. Thank you for Loi to provide the opportunity to meet the two guest speakers. Mr. Kirby, one question. If we look at the behaviour of the North Korean state in one specific example, and this may have been covered in your report, I haven't read it in full. You mentioned the famine. Children orphaned through the famine would become wards of the state, presumably. What has the North Korean government's behaviour been in providing health and welfare and education to that demographic? Have they failed, and have they been at risk of their health and welfare being compromised by being slave labour or traded for sex or whatever? That particular demographic, how's North Korea dealt with their responsibility as wards
this
of state
is
orphans?
Dealt with in the report. There's an extensive discussion of trafficking. There's extensive discussion of opportunistic sexual encounters, such as happen in every unstable international situation. And there is extensive discussion of malnutrition amongst children, the stunting of children, the lower height of the people of North Korea in comparison to South Korea, who've been well nourished. So all of this is recorded, and all of these are very serious and ongoing problems, and they're humanitarian issues. And I was glad to see, as I said this morning, was an email from the people who speak for the Security Council giving what countries have to do in order to get security, humanitarian aid to North Korea that bypasses the system of sanctions, because the little children of North Korea don't deserve to be waiting another 20 years whilst they're debating the design of the table, as they did in the Vietnam negotiations. We've got to do something, and urgently. And the opportunity was presented, and President Moon was right to seize that opportunity, but it's now a matter of broadening the focus, because with all respect, the only human rights that are mentioned in the four-point agreement were the human rights of dead US servicemen. Not all UN servicemen were mentioned. Australian servicemen were not mentioned, and our Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, this morning referred to that. You know, there are countries other than America, and America going great again. We've got to think of this as a world, and certainly a regional, and certainly a six-power concern. But it could be done. There's no doubt it could be done. with due respect to human rights as well. Not everything that every human rights person thinks should be achieved, but it shouldn't be swept under the carpet and forgotten. The wrongs are too great, and they include the list that you mentioned.
Hi there, Mike Belmore from PwC. Bit of a different question. Often we see cultural differences between countries and nations, like we've seen between Canada and Saudi Arabia. I'm interested to know, does the panel see a line in the sand of when a cultural difference becomes a humanitarian rights issue? I mean, some people in the US feel it's their human right to walk around with an AK-47. Where do you see the cultural differences, for example, some that North Korea might have, become human rights issues?
Well, that is something that is constantly raised in the Human Rights Council and is one of the American objections to the Human Rights Council, that what seems important to countries critical of Israel, completely unimportant to the United States, and disproportion within the Human Rights Council that not many other countries see. But the UN tried to meet this problem at the outset by creating a commission of inquiry that included an Australian judge, a lawyer of great experience, a prosecutor general of Indonesia, and a person who had a lot of experience with genocide in Serbia. So it's a European, a person from the Asian main area, ASEAN, and an Australian. And I think we brought to the table a sensitivity to different cultural norms. But the notion behind the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the notion behind the United Nations Charter, which envisaged that UDHR, is that there are fundamental human rights. And when I was Special Representative of the Secretary General in Cambodia, I posed this question to people who'd been the victims of the Khmer Rouge. And I said, did you ever feel during that time that your basic rights were being traduced? They looked at me with astonishment that I would be so naive and stupid as to ask such a question. Of course we did, but there was nothing we could do. We were powerless. And I don't think we should necessarily go along with the idea that because people are Asian, they're not concerned about human rights. They've got an awful lot of horrible regimes in Asia, and they are not regimes with the true consent of the governed. Look at Cambodia this very week. And therefore, you know, there are human rights, there are fundamental human rights, there are crimes against humanity, and where they exist, the world said it would respond. And this is a test for us. And if we don't respond now, we won't respond in the future. And if we don't respond to nuclear weapon peril now, including the United States and the P5 and the nuclear states, then the long-term future of the human species must be in doubt. I mean, that's bluntly the fact. And therefore, this is a test for us. And we've got to find a solution to it. Our species and our long-term future of humanity depend on it.
I think that's a very excellent note to end on. The kind of world we want to live in. I mean, these are issues that are not just about this moment in one particular place. These are issues about the kind of future of humanity that we want to create. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming and being part of this discussion. And please join me in thanking Dr. Shin and Mr. Kirby very warmly. Thank you.